This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. As a former purveyor of hate, our guest Christian Piccolini is passionate about now working to expose and undermine racist hate groups. He joined a skinhead neo-Nazi group as a teenager and became a leader in one of the most violent white supremacist groups in the nation. As you'll hear, he hurt a lot of innocent people. And as the frontman for a white power punk band, he wrote and performed songs that inspired others to commit racist acts of violence. After 8 years, Piccolini withdrew from the movement and eventually co-founded a group called Life After Hate that works to bring others out of white supremacist groups. Piccolini has a new memoir called White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. He spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Christian Piccolini, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you describe an encounter when you were 14 with a white power leader in an alley. What happened?
You know, I was just a normal youth, Dave, and I had been marginalized for many of those years. And one day when I was 14 years old, I was standing in an alley. The year was 1987, and I was smoking a joint. And the man who was twice my age came up to me and he pulled the joint from my lips and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." Now, at 14, I didn't really know what a communist or a Jew was. And to be quite honest, I didn't really know what the word docile meant either. But it seemed at that time that it was the first moment where somebody had given me a lifeline of acceptance. Having grown up the son of Italian immigrants, I didn't really know what my identity was. And this man, who happened to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, drew me in through those vulnerabilities.
And this was Clark Martel, right, who was a leader of the movement at the time?
He was at a time when nobody in America really knew what a skinhead was or what a neo-Nazi skinhead was. He seemed to me to be everything that I wanted to be. And when I say that, I don't mean racist, because I didn't really grow up with that as part of my family DNA. In fact, because my parents are immigrants, they were often the victims of prejudice. But what I saw in him was charisma and leadership and a sense of what I thought was respect. And I had gone from a powerless young person to somebody who suddenly, when I adopted that look and that ideology, became what I perceived to be very powerful.
You know, you write that people don't get into these kinds of groups or other kinds of terrorist groups so much because of ideology, but out of a personal need for community, identity, some kind of fulfillment. You didn't come from a broken or abusive home. Where do you think your need came from?
I felt abandoned by my parents, not understanding at that age that my parents, as immigrants, had to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day to survive in a foreign country. And as a young person, I just wondered what I had done to push them away, why they weren't there. And I went in search of a new family. But you're right, I don't believe that ideology nor dogma are what drive people to extremism. I believe it's a broken search for three very fundamental human needs of identity, community, and purpose.
But when you were getting into this and you were hearing that Jews and blacks and Mexicans were the enemy, I mean, to what extent did that square with any of your own experience or opinions?
Well, it didn't start that way. It started out with Clark and several of the older skinheads in this group appealing to my sense of pride of being European, of being Italian. And then it would move on to instilling fear that I would lose that pride and that somebody would take that away from me if I wasn't careful. And then it went on to name specific groups through conspiracy theories that were bent on taking that pride or that privilege away from me. So it was the fear rhetoric. And then I, you know, at a very young age thought, gosh, these older guys know what they're talking about. I don't want to seem stupid. They seem to know the secret. And I bought in simply because, at first because I wanted to belong. Now, that doesn't absolve me from the responsibility of what I did for those 8 years that I was involved, because I did swallow the ideology and I did pass that along to other people. But I can tell you that every single person that I recruited or that was recruited around the same time that I did, up to now, up to what we're seeing today, is recruited through vulnerabilities and not through ideology.
You know, you write that there was a turning point when you went to a meeting at an apartment in Naperville, Illinois. Tell us about that.
That meeting was in 1987 or early 88, and that was the first gathering of what became the Hammerskin Nation. And that meeting was when I was 14 years old, and I was in a room full of about 30 skinheads from all over the country who had tried to come under one umbrella. There were disparate groups all around the country popping up after it started in Chicago, and the goal was to try and unify everybody. But that was the first time that I felt a sort of energy flow through me that I had never felt before, as if I was a part of something greater than myself. Even at 14 years old, when I was desperately searching for that purpose, this seemed to fill it, and I certainly I bought in.
You became part of a group called, I guess, CASH, Chicago Area Skinheads. And this was at a time when you write that there were other skinhead groups popping up around town, some of whom didn't adopt the white supremacist neo-Nazi approach that your group did. Who were these other groups, and what kind of contact did you have with them?
Well, I think first it's important to note that the skinhead subculture didn't start out as a racist one in the 60s in England. It started out as a subculture just like any other punk rock movement or rebellious movement, and it didn't really lean towards any sort of politics. But in the 70s, it did become political, and there was a schism, and we have what we call anti-racist skinheads, and perhaps maybe now what we're calling Antifa, and the racist skinheads. And it was a difficult time because we didn't really, although we claimed who our enemy was, we thought that the enemy was the Jews and minorities and government. We spent most of our time actually fighting against other white anti-racist activists for most of those years.
So actual fist fights, you'd meet and rumble?
We would meet and rumble, but we would also just attack indiscriminately. Not only anti-racist activists, but people of color, homeless people. And it was, for us, our expression of our low self-esteem to be able to project our own pain, I think, onto other people. And I certainly recognize that now and didn't then.
I want to talk a little bit more about your time in the movement. Music was a big part of this, and you formed this band, White American Youth. And I thought we would listen to a cut. I don't know whether you listen to this anymore at all or not.
No.
I thought we should hear a little bit about it. This is from an album that you were the singer, right? You were the front man, right?
That's correct.
And this is from an album called Walk Alone, and the track we're going to hear a little of is from a song called America For Me. That's America with a KKK rather than a C. Let's listen. And that's our guest, Christian Picciolini, in another life, singing with the band White American Youth. What's it like to hear that again?
Well, it brings back a lot of shame, because I know that I put words out into the world that still today are affecting people and hurting people. I learned just a few months ago that Dylan Roof had heard one of my songs a few months before he committed the tragedy in Charleston. And he was on a white supremacist web forum asking who the band was, and somebody had showed me that post just recently, and I read through the lyrics, and it didn't dawn on me instantly that those were my lyrics, but when I'd finished, I felt sick. To know that my words still today might be encouraging people, might be putting false ideas into the world, and might still be hurting people.
Mm. You know, the music has a lot of energy and a lot of anger to it. I mean, how much of a connection is there that between this kind of, the emotion of that kind of music and the violence of the movement, do you think?
I think it's very connected. At least it was during the 80s and 90s. Music was the vehicle for propaganda. It was the incitement to encourage people to commit acts of violence. And it was a social movement. People would come in for the very few concerts that were held every year from all over the country or all over the world. And it was a way to gather. And still today, I believe that music is a very powerful tool that the movement uses to inspire vulnerable young people into a very hateful social movement.
You know, you engaged in a lot of violence in those years, random attacks on people, and you recount one case in particular where you and some other guys set upon some young black kids who were in a McDonald's, chased them into the street and beat them up. Did you ever any of those moments feel empathy with any of your victims?
That moment that you're talking about in the McDonald's was a pivotal moment for me. Here I was, 18 or 19 years old, the leader of one of the most prominent neo-Nazi skinhead organizations in the world, and I was with a group of friends who walked into this McDonald's after a night of heavy drinking and loudly proclaimed that it was my McDonald's and that they had to leave. And of course, they were intimidated and they ran out, and we chased them. And one of the black teenagers, as he was running across the street, pulled out a gun and started to fire at us, and the gun jammed. And we caught that individual and proceeded to beat him very, very badly. And as I was kicking him when he was on the ground, his eyes opened and they looked at mine. And I remember feeling a very deep connection or a deep empathy for this person that I didn't know that I was essentially trying to kill. And when our eyes connected, I thought for an instant that that could be somebody that I loved, could be my brother, could be my mother or father, and that there would be people that would be impacted by my actions. And that was the last time I committed an act of violence. And I don't know who that individual was, and I don't know what happened to him, but that moment changed my life.
What else made you think differently about the movement?
Over the years, I always had confusion and questions about my ideologies because it wasn't the way that I was raised. But ultimately, what it came down to was receiving compassion from the people that I least deserved it when I least deserved it. Just before I left the movement, I opened a record store to sell white power music that I was importing from all over the world. In fact, I was one of the only stores in the United States that was selling this music. And I also knew that to stay in the community and get their support, I would have to sell other music. So I started to sell punk rock music and heavy metal and hip hop. And when the customers came in to buy that music, who were often African American or Jewish or gay, at first I was very standoffish, but they kept coming back. And the community, even though it's Chicago, everybody knew what I was doing. Everybody knew how hateful I was and how violent I was. But these customers came in despite that. And over time, I started to have meaningful interactions with them for the first time in my life. In fact, I'd never in my life engaged in a meaningful dialogue with the people that I thought I hated. And it was these folks who showed me empathy when I least deserved it. They were the ones that I least deserved it from. And I started to recognize that I had more in common with them than the people I'd surrounded myself for 8 years with. And that these people that I thought I hated took it upon themselves to see something inside of me that I didn't even see myself. And it was because of that connection that I was able to humanize them, and that destroyed the demonization and the prejudice that was happening inside of me.
How did the record store come to an end?
When I became too embarrassed to sell the white power music in front of my customers, which I now considered friends, I decided to pull the white power music. And of course, because it was 75% of my revenue, the store had to close.
It was some years after that you left the movement that you co-founded a group called Life After Hate, right? And I understand you're no longer working with them, but this was an effort to undo some of the damage, to try and rescue people from this kind of hatred. You know, it's easy to give speeches to people who agree with you. How did you try and connect with people who were still in the movement and bring them out?
Well, first, I recognized I needed to make amends for the damage that I had done. And the only way I really knew how to do that was to share my story so that hopefully other people could learn from my mistakes. I didn't really understand how to head on accept responsibility for it. So I started to tell my story, and I started to recognize in 2009, when I co-founded Life After Hate as a literary magazine, that other people shared the same experience that I had. And very quickly, this online magazine started to elicit responses from people all over the world who wanted to share their stories and who thought maybe they were the only ones who had gone through that and who had left. Very quickly, I recognized that in order to help people, I wanted to work with them one-on-one, that they needed a support community, that if we were going to pull them out of an identity and a community and a purpose that was negative or detrimental to them or society, that we needed to also provide them with a positive alternative for that. So Life After Hate became, perhaps still is, one of America's only organizations, nonprofits, that are focused on helping people disengage from white supremacy and from hate movements. I've continued that work. I parted ways with Life After Hate last year to launch a global intervention providers network. I've traveled all over the world. I've been lucky to do that and share my story with groups in every community on almost every continent. And what I've recognized is that there are people already doing the same work that I was doing, perhaps not in the same capacity. There are organizations in Mali of mothers who are helping young people not go into extremist groups. There are ex-foreign fighters from Lebanon who are trying to de-radicalize young people so that they don't make the same mistakes. And I started to understand that there really wasn't a recognizable place for people to go to for help. People who wanted to disengage themselves, but also for bystanders, loved ones who were concerned about somebody that may be going down a dark path. So my goal now is to take these organizations who operate independently and bring them into a global network where we can share best practices, where we can perhaps feed each other individuals who could benefit more from a local approach.
I understand that in the closing months of the Obama administration, the Department of Homeland Security gave Life After Hate a $400,000 grant to fund its services, among other grants that they give to other, you know, anti-terrorist organizations. That ended when Trump came into office, right?
That's correct. So 2 weeks before President Obama left office, we were awarded a $400,000 grant to expand our intervention services online. A few weeks after the president took office, we were notified that the grant was rescinded for us. Out of the nearly 40 organizations that were promised grants, we were one of maybe two that were rescinded. And we were the only organization that was completely focused on the far right and white supremacists. And fortunately, momentum of society and people's concerns for the loss of that grant ended up in donations of over $500,000 to the organization. So we were able to recover that.
One thing, when we were talking about the Trump administration having rescinded the $400,000 grant, do you know why? Were you given any explanation?
You know, I don't want to speculate. I mean, certainly the administration change, you know, made things a little bit trickier, and certainly there was a different focus. But, you know, I find it very disheartening that we still have a problem calling white extremism terrorism in our country. When in fact, since 9/11, more Americans have been killed on U.S. soil by white supremacists than they have by any other foreign or domestic terrorist group combined. Part of that is because we don't have domestic terrorism statutes on the books. But also part of that is because I think we have a hard time holding a mirror up to ourselves and admitting our failures. So I don't know what the reason is, but I can tell you that there is an overwhelming focus in the counterterrorism space and the countering violent extremism space on you know, Islamist terrorism, and not enough of a focus. And I believe our government should be looking at this threat that all of our intelligence agencies agree is a massive problem in our country today.
Well, Christian Piccolini, I wish you luck in your efforts. Then thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Dave. Thank you so much.
Christian Piccolini's new memoir is called White American Youth. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Wes Montgomery was one of the most famous jazz and pop guitar players ever. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Montgomery was a virtuoso with a good head for melody. A new reissue catches Montgomery's quartet on the guitarist's only European tour.
That's from the double album, Wes Montgomery in Paris, the definitive ORTF recording, part of Resonance Records' Montgomery archival series. This 1965 concert, caught for French radio, has been bootlegged a few times in various forms, but this crisp edition was mastered from the original tapes, and as usual, Resonance pays the musicians or their survivors. The guitarist is in fine form and enthralled to the splashy modal jazz John Coltrane made popular in the 60s, with longer improvisations over fewer chords. Wes Montgomery even tackles Coltrane's blowing tune, Impressions. As ever, he'll play lines in parallel octaves for a sleek, clean, irresistible sound. Wes Montgomery didn't just have a great sound. He'd weave complex variations around melodic figures that might start out simple and catchy as a children's song. The complications were always elegant, and somehow he picked all that fancy stuff, sweeping the strings with his bare right thumb. This is from the same solo. Wes Montgomery, 1965, with drummer Jimmy Lovelace and bassist Arthur Harper. All those sparkling guitar runs and octaves prompt pianist Harold Mayburn to trot out some ringing octaves of his own. That's on Montgomery's 4-on-6, where you can hear that Coltrane influence. Sometimes, Harold Mayburn shadows Wes Montgomery so closely, piano almost sounds like another neck on Wes's guitar. After playing with Montgomery a little while, the pianist knew his pet rhythms and would lock right in. Sitting in on three numbers that night in Paris was the terrific Chicago tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin, who'd moved to France a couple of years before after recording with Montgomery in the States. The typically excitable and exciting Griffin brings some darker color to the mix and even more bluesy energy. When his European tour was over, Wes Montgomery began a new phase of his career, making pop-oriented, easier-listening albums. As three ballads on Wes Montgomery and Paris demonstrate, he also sounded good just caressing a melody. Those later records made him more widely beloved, but you can understand why some old fans felt let down. They knew how good Wes sounded when he was really wailing.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Wes Montgomery in Paris from Resonance Records. Coming up, Patrice Banks talks about why she left her career as an engineer for DuPont to open an auto repair shop with women mechanics and an adjoining nail salon. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When one of those warning lights in your car turns on, or you're hearing disturbing noises coming from the engine, the stress might get even worse when you get to the auto shop. If you don't know and trust your mechanic, you might not know if you're being overcharged or charged for things you don't even need. And for women, it's often even more stressful because the garage is such a guy atmosphere. And let's face it, a lot of women don't know much about cars. These are problems my guest Patrice Banks is trying to address. 1 year ago, she opened the Girls Auto Clinic Repair Center in Philadelphia, a shop with women mechanics. To make the shop more appealing and convenient for women, she opened an adjoining manicure-pedicure blowout salon. Now Banks has a new book called The Girls Auto Clinic Glove Box Guide, which offers basic information that women, really everyone, ought to know about their car. The book also tells Banks' story. She grew up poor with a single mother. She knew nothing about how her cars worked, disregarded maintenance, and felt stupid when it came to cars. But eventually, she realized she didn't need to feel incompetent. At the time, she was a successful engineer at DuPont, where part of her job was performing what's called root cause failure analysis on million-dollar pieces of manufacturing equipment. She says it required doing things like climbing up into towers 100 feet in the air in coveralls, a hard hat, and steel-toed boots to check on huge tanks filled with hydrochloric acid. She wanted to do something empowering for women and for herself, and she wanted to be an entrepreneur. So she went back to school and studied auto mechanics and started working toward her goal. Patrice Banks, welcome to Fresh Air. Give us an example of something that happened to you when you took your car into the shop and you were uncomfortable or you felt like you were being taken advantage of in some way.
Yeah, millions of times. Anytime I went in for an oil change, right? You go into the quick lube place and you're expecting to spend $35 and they come out, they want to show you filters, this is going to be $40 and you need these fluid flushes, and I had no idea. You know, they'd look at me and say, what type of oil do you want? And I'd say, isn't that something you're supposed to know? Like synthetic or regular, and they try to upsell you on the more expensive stuff and using terms that I didn't know if it was helpful or not. You know, there were times when I was probably not being taken advantage of and I said no because I had no idea. But most of the times it was upselling on filters. Do I really need that air filter every time I come in for an oil change? So even things like that. But I have one really bad experience where I had a light flashing on my Ford Explorer dashboard. I had no clue what it meant. It said O/D, and it was a pretty new car, only a couple years old. And so I took it to a dealership, and they told me it was going to cost $2,000. It needs some sensor replaced, but it was located on the transmission, and they had to take the whole transmission apart. And I'm thinking, this car is only like 3 years old, and I have to. And I was still paying a car note, and I had to pay $2,000 for a repair.
What does the OD light mean?
Overdrive off. Now I know what it means. It's something related to the four-wheel drive. And so it was something I didn't even really need to have unless I wanted to use the four-wheel drive on the Ford Explorer, right? And so...
Wait. So they redid your transmission when it had nothing to do with...
Well, it was an electrical component that had failed and needed to be replaced, but it was located on the transmission, and they had to drop the transmission pan this other stuff to get to it just to replace it. And so that's why it was costing all of this money for them to do it. And I thought it had to be done.
It didn't have to be done?
No, if I didn't want to use four-wheel drive, no. And so that's something like they should have educated. Listen, if you want to get, you still use your four-wheel drive, yes. Make sure you get this fixed right now. We can disable it. It's not a big deal, but they're not concerned about that. They want $2,000.
Okay, so a lot of women have problems when they take in their car. Most women don't decide, therefore, I'm going to start my own garage.
Yeah.
You decided, therefore, I'm going to start my own garage. Why did you want to do that?
Yeah, I didn't really look into starting my own garage at first. I was looking for a female mechanic. I had a great career at DuPont. It wasn't like, I'm going to go be a mechanic now. I knew that I wanted to learn more about my car. And I was tired of feeling helpless and having to go talk to a guy. I'm talking to my girlfriends, asking them what their feelings are, and they're like, my car, I always feel taken advantage of, I don't know anything. And so I'm like, there's a need, right? I did a small little test research with friends and people around me, and I said, there's a need for something like this. And that's when I decided to create a business that was going to cater to women and help them with this information and resources. But I couldn't find a female mechanic, so I had to learn it. So I thought, well, I'm gonna have to learn this myself, and I'm gonna go back to school and learn.
So that's what I decided. You went back to school, you studied auto mechanics?
I started a shop. And so it wasn't really the initial idea to start a shop. I didn't get that idea until I started talking to my cousin. I have a cousin named Peach, and she's about my age, a little younger. And I'm just telling her, I'm looking for a female mechanic. I'm telling her my experience. And she said, I always wanted to be a mechanic. Growing up, she has a very similar story to mine. Single mom, grew up very, really poor, and her mom couldn't afford to get the car fixed. Every time it would break down, it was an old car. They'd have to walk really far to school, and her mom would have to walk to work. So she said, I always wanted to be a mechanic so I could fix my mom's car. She gets to high school, talks to her counselors and teachers, I want to be a mechanic, and she's discouraged because she's pretty, she's tiny, she's too petite, you're not going to make money. She said, I always wanted to have my own garage with a nail salon. I'm like, let's do it. Let's do it, because I want to educate women. We're having these problems.
And
we need empowerment. Yes, let's do it. So I started looking at schools to enroll in, and I started telling everybody, I want to open a shop. I want to cater to women. I want to help women when it comes to their cars so they're more confident with the choices they make. And everyone just thought, yeah, duh, right? Why hasn't this been done before? That makes tons of sense.
So did your cousin become a mechanic too?
She did not. So, you know, because she was in school at the time already and kind of had a new path that she wanted to take out instead of just, she wasn't in a position to just change her career and what she was doing. I was already working as an engineer for 12 years and looking for my passion. So in a way to make my contribution. So I was ready for it. And I told her, I'm going to go on and do this. And she said, go ahead. So yeah, I enrolled in school and I started taking classes at night while I was working during the day at Delaware Technical Community College. I was the only girl with a bunch of boys, 19-year-old boys. And that was interesting.
You were what, 30?
I was 31.
Okay, so when you decided that you're going to complete the auto school, start your own shop, you said you couldn't find any women mechanics when you were looking for somebody to fix your car. So how are you going to find a mechanic to help you in your shop?
Yeah, I love this question because I was telling people I'm going to open a shop with female mechanics and I can't find a mechanic. So I'm in school, and as soon as I'm learning, I can't wait to teach women. So while I was still in school, I started teaching workshops and car care workshops. And I was doing them for free every month. Whoever shows up, you want to learn about your car, you're going to learn on your car. And the word started getting out. And I didn't have to find any of these women. They found me because somebody would tell them about me. You got to check out this woman. I gave a TED talk. I started getting some press. And I was always talking about, I want to open a shop with female mechanics. And this was 2 years before I even opened. I was like, this is my dream. This is what I want to do. And all of the women came to me and emailed me or showed up at a workshop saying, this has been my dream. I always wanted to have a shop. I didn't know where to start. I'd love to work for you. I'd love to help you. I believe in what you're doing. I have 5 female mechanics at my shop now, and they all found me. I didn't have to look for them. And they're incredible.
Did you ever try working in somebody else's shop?
Yes. So I absolutely. So once I went back to school to learn how cars worked, I said, I need to learn how to run a business. And it's an interesting story, too, because I was offering to work for free. I was still working at DuPont. And I said, I just want to learn. I have all this experience. I'll help you with your business. Anything you need me to do, I want to work for free. I'm here to learn. I was turned down by 3 places before the 4th one said yes. And the 4th one was a shop called Guy's Auto Clinic here in Philly. And I worked there for free for 2 years and just learned how to run a shop. It was a small shop, which with a smart head technician, a guy who ran it.
I'm just going to stop you here and say that guy was actually the name of the owner.
Is the name of the owner.
It wasn't like the men's shop, the guy's shop.
Yeah, Guy was the name of the owner, like Guy, French, yeah. But that's where we got Girls Auto Clinic from, right? So it's an interesting story because I was turned down like 3 times. People said no, and I'm like, but I'm willing to work for free. You get that? And they were like, no, you're going to take my customers. One guy's wife didn't want me working there. Another guy just didn't think I was going to be good enough.
Because of jealousy?
Yeah, because I was a woman. She didn't want a woman working. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was just meant to be, start something at Guy's Auto Clinic. So, and then I went to another bigger shop. He was a small shop in West Philly, One Bay. I knew I needed something a little bit bigger because I wanted my shop to be bigger. So I went and started working for free at another shop called Keller's Auto. And he's in Roxborough, Philadelphia. And he had a lot bigger operations there, and I ran the shop for him, the front of the house, and learned a lot about how to start up and run a shop. And I was working there for about 4 months, and he was getting really frustrated because he had some workers who just weren't reliable. And one day he had just had a really bad day, and he goes, I want to hire you full time. I'm still working for DuPont, by the way, like making like $100,000 a year. And he's like, I'll pay you $600 a week. I was like, all right, well, this is it. I either need to make the decision to quit my job and take this next step, or I may never do this. And so that's when the next day I went in and told my boss at DuPont, I gave them a month.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrice Banks. She's the author of the new book, Girls Auto Clinic, A Glove Box Guide. And in addition to writing this book about cars, she also started an all-women's auto repair shop, which is called Girls Auto Clinic. and it adjoins a mani-pedi salon with blowouts.
Yes.
Why did you want to combine the two?
It's funny because, you know, you don't realize how you manifest some of these things in your life earlier before I even had this idea. Me and my girlfriend that I worked at DuPont would go to the specific Jiffy Lube on our lunch break because there was a nail salon next to it. We'd drop our cars off and we'd walk next door and we'd get our nails done. And we thought we were
While you waited for your
car? While we waited. So we just thought we were the smartest people because it's lunch. We're killing three birds, right? We're getting lunch. We're out for lunch. We're getting our oil changed. We're getting our nails done. And we're back at work, you know, all in about 45 minutes to an hour. It was fabulous. And we would do that like every couple of months when we needed our oils changed. And I started thinking about opening this shop. And remember I told you my cousin was like, I always wanted a nail salon. I'm like, that just makes sense because women, we hate going in to get our oil changed. It's always a chore. It's always a burden. But we look forward to doing things like getting our nails done. And so I thought it would just be cute and just, it's kind of like the cherry on the top when I tell people, I have a shop that caters to women, full service auto repair, all female mechanics. They're like, whoa. I'm like, and there's a nail salon there. They're like, what? I'm there.
Okay, let me see your nails.
Oh, I need to get them redone, actually.
Let me see. Okay.
I'm embarrassed.
All right. They're kind of like half polished.
Yeah, because I'm getting them done today. I'm actually getting them done today.
Here's the thing. If your hands are kind of taking out spark plugs mm-hmm. and changing oil, mm-hmm. it is not the perfect work for like a finely
manicured
shaped
nails.
Nail and a manicure and everything.
Yeah.
The two don't seem to me to go together
yeah.
very well.
Uh-huh. My employees love getting their nails done, and it's great because our nails get so dirty at work, we can just go pop next door and get a nice, fresh manicure, right? My shop foreman, she's also a cosmetologist and does nails herself. She's coming in with the stiletto nails, right? They rock it. There's no stereotypes like you can't have the heels, right? You can't wear makeup. You can't have nails and be pretty. These women are just themselves. And some of them don't wear makeup or nails, but some of them do. And that doesn't stop them. It doesn't make them less of a tech or less smart, right?
So you didn't grow up around cars. Your family mm-hmm. didn't have a car. Your mother was on welfare a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
When she did work, she sometimes would walk 4 miles to mm-hmm. and from work.
Yeah.
So she couldn't afford a car. You were raised by a single mother. How old were you when you got your first car?
I was 16.
That's pretty
young. Yeah, I was the first
young.
One to have a car in the
How'd
house.
How'd you afford to buy a car?
I worked three jobs. I was definitely, my mom wasn't an empowered woman, and I don't know.
Was or was not?
It was not an empowered woman. And so I kind of had to step up and be someone in charge at the house.
What was not empowered about her?
She was just always looking for a man to love her. I mean, growing up, we were, suffered physical and sexual abuse. From her boyfriends, and she wasn't educated. She never had really great jobs. She was always just kind of worried about chasing a man and getting love and not really, how do I love my children? How do I be a better person? How do I empower myself to make my contribution? And so for that reason, you know, she has kids, but I was kind of the only one in my family to make it out. Most of the people in my family were like that growing up poor and as a minority. I didn't see many examples of success stories. But I just always knew that I wanted to get out of this place. And if I was going to get out, it meant my education and working hard.
Did it mean a car?
And a car. My car was freedom. I couldn't wait to leave the house. I hated being in a very unstable, abusive household. So I was always trying to leave. And I put my energy into positive things, like working to get a car so I could go to college, so I could get out and never come back. That's kind of how I looked at it. Yeah. So I was 16 when I was the first one to have a car, and I worked three jobs. When I was in high school, I was a hustler. I had my own insurance at 16 and my own car. And it felt good. I felt like, you know, like it was the freedom, and you couldn't tell me anything because I was 16 years old and kind of already taking care of myself.
So your new book is a glove mm-hmm. Glove compartment
yes,
guide.
Yes.
So let's talk about some basics.
Okay.
Some easy to learn things about the car that doesn't require looking under the hood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's easy to do that too.
All right. So, but we can't do that on the radio.
Right.
So let's start mm-hmm. with should I always buy the most expensive gas? Should I go for premium?
Right. No, you shouldn't. What you do need to know, and so one of the first things I talk about is what's the difference? Do you know the difference? And people don't know. And they just kind
know.
Of go what people tell. The difference in the grades of gas is the temperature that the engine burns the gas. And so if you have an engine designed to burn 87, which is the regular grade, if you put premium gas in it, you're not doing it any good, right? Because the engine's not designed to burn the gas at that temperature. Now, if you have an engine like, you know, a BMW, that's more sophisticated and engineered and high performance, it's gonna need the high performance gas because its engine was designed to burn it and compress it at a different temperature. And so there is no, like, if I put the premium gas, it's going to help my engine run better. We have all types of sensors, fuel injector cleaners, things that we can do to prevent that. So, yeah, how you know what type of gas you should have is by looking in your owner's manual. A lot of times it'll be on the gas door. But one of the things that I tell women is, like, luxury cars. If you have a luxury car, it's going to be more expensive for the gas, for the fluids, for the repair. Everything's more expensive on it. Keep that in mind. The most important decision that you can make for your car is the type of car you buy. I see it all the time where women will get a really cute, nice car, especially if it's like a fancier one, like a Mini Cooper that's really a BMW, and they can't afford to fix it. Like my problem, I had a $2,000 car note and still paying a car, you know, or $2,000 payment and still paying a car note.
What's your rule of thumb about when to give up a car? When it's not worth spending more money repairing?
Yes, this is always difficult to give up the baby. And it's usually when, I tell people, and it's going to require a little bit of math, unless you just want to use your gut and say I'm over it. But if you're really not afraid to go into the math and you want to make sure you make the right decision on when to let it go, it's about understanding if you start getting repairs that cost more than like twice the car is worth, then you want to start getting rid of it. So it's knowing how much the car is worth and how much you're spending on it every year to do these repairs or every couple of months. And if it's the repairs are getting to be more than twice the value of the car, it's time to get rid of it.
Well, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, and so you'll see people come in with a car that needs a new engine and it's going to be $3,000 and the car is only worth like $2,500. So we're like, nah, I wouldn't do that.
Well, good luck to you and thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, of course.
Patrice Banks is the author of The Girls Auto Clinic Glove Box Guide.